Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. This month marks the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, which continued for more than 4 years and set in motion so many of the political and societal dynamics that shaped the rest of the 20th century and continued into older times as well. So I've been doing a lot of reading lately about what was initially called the Great War, and then in the term that H.G. Wells coined, the war to all end all wars. Then it was called the World War, until, of course, the Second World War broke out in 1939. Well, I decided this was the time for me to figure out, get a more clear understanding of what started it, because like a lot of people, I just couldn't see how the assassination of the heir to one country's throne resulted in this huge conflagration in which so many millions of people were killed, combatants and civilians alike. So in this program, I'm going to pass along to you what I've learned in this recent study of World War I. And you can see then how what happened then set the terms for so much of what we're still dealing with. So first of all, what was the significance of World War I? Why would we even think about it now? Well, it quite suddenly ended four imperial governments that had been in place for hundreds of years. There was the Hohenzollern dynasty, the Prussians, and Kaiser Wilhelm then was the Prussian head of the unified German state, unified since 1871. And then there was the Romanov dynasty in Russia, headed by Tsar Nicholas II. And then there was the Ottoman Empire, ruling Turkey and many conquered lands. And there was the Habsburg dynasty, ruling the Austro-Hungarian Empire with Franz Joseph at the head, Emperor Franz Joseph. So none of these four major powers imagined at the outset of the war that it would bring their overthrow and dissolution. And you can say, well, of course, it was a good thing that those despotic regimes were ended, and that's very true. But the way it happened was so much chaos and violence and then ad hoc scrambling led to outcomes that were very much compromised and led to still more ongoing suffering that was brought on the populace in many of those countries. And World War I also introduced chemical weapons, aerial bombardment, including the first very purposeful aerial bombardment of a city full of civilians, tanks, and newly huge guns that had never been seen. And World War I also brought changes on the home front. Millions of women went into the workforce to take over lots of jobs that were vacated by men who were drafted into the army or enlisted. But clerical jobs, transport, munitions, all kinds of jobs brought a lot of women out of the home for the first time. And so afterward, the objections to women getting the vote fell away because they had contributed so significantly to the war effort. And in some countries, that was a direct deal. In England, the suffragists or suffrage activists, you know, said, we'll help with the war effort. We'll stop our campaign for suffrage as long as we get it right after the war. So the aftermath of World War I also brought independence to a number of countries like Ukraine. This is temporary, Poland temporary, the Baltic countries, again, only to be swallowed up by Russia later. And it also created new states in the Middle East. But these are often drawn by the ruling powers with arbitrary borders. And as we've seen, this has contributed to so much of the current strife in the Middle East. And it also resulted in jamming together three very old cultural nations into one state. Now, the definition of political geography of a nation is an indigenous or long-standing cultural entity. A state is the modern legal entity, which really took shape after the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. So when they use the term nation state, that's not accurate except for very few places on Earth, like Monaco and Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, very tiny places where the cultural nation there from the Middle Ages is also the same boundaries and group as the modern legal state. In most cases, the modern legal state has boundaries that just engulfed the lands of ancient nations or cut right through the middle of them. So anyway, one example was jamming those three very old cultural nations together into this artificial state called Yugoslavia after World War One, and 70 years later, those very old nations, cultural nations, had to fight for their independence, which they should have gotten back at the Treaty of Versailles, but we'll talk about why that didn't happen. World War One also brought about numerous cultural changes, so one of the big ones was this new attention to the psychological damage that's done by war, what was then called shell shock and other forms of post-traumatic stress. And for the United Nations, World War One resulted in our emergence as a global power. President Woodrow Wilson introduced the notion of the United States as a broker of the peace among those decaying powers of the old world. And he established the concepts of internationalism and self-determination. And, of course, he had the dream of founding the League of Nations, but he couldn't get it ratified for our membership, couldn't get it ratified in the U.S. Senate. And while he was out giving it his all and campaigning for that, he had a stroke, very serious stroke. So... In the end, some 17 million people were killed during World War One, 10 million combatants, and 7 million civilians. This was new and different, and oh, how modern. And also 20 million people were wounded. Now, one-third of the combatant deaths were from the influenza epidemic of 1918 and other diseases. It spread really quickly. In, for instance, the recruitment and deployment centers, where after we entered the war, a lot of young men from around the country, and we had a draft after May of 1917, would be brought, you know, to concentrated bases on the East Coast before they were shipped to Europe. So the flu spread very quickly in those conditions, and also across Europe. So the cost of it, all told, is about $185 billion, and a substantial chunk of that was in the form of loans that Russia and then England both took out repeatedly from the American banker J.P. Morgan. And he also became the purchasing agent representative in the United States for Britain's military materials. And on every procurement invoice, J.P. Morgan got a cut. And because he was such a high-profile war profiteer, someone broke into his Fifth Avenue mansion and shot at him. But back to the larger story, the aftermath of the aftermath of violent revolution and state bankruptcy, financial collapse, all this fed into the conditions in the following decades that made it easier for the rise of Hitler and Mussolini to happen, and then World War II, and then the Cold War, and even the turmoil in the Middle East today. So you're probably familiar with the famous slogan by the Prussian war theorist Clausewitz, that war is the continuation of politics by other means. But Barbara Tuchman, in her Pulitzer Prize-winning history, military history of the first month of the war called The Guns of August, 1962, she said, that should actually be altered when you look at the history of this to be, war is the continuation of the failure of politics by other means. there was a tradition in Germanic cultures about war being ennobling, and nobody believed that after World War I, although Hitler was able to ramp it all up again. So anyway, to wrap our minds around this complex phenomenon that was the Great War, we'll look at it in three main areas: why the war was fought, how the war was fought, and the aftermath of the war. So, why this huge, complex battle came to be was the main reason I started looking at all this. And then I saw a quote recently from a history professor at Yale who said, "I've been studying this war for 30 years, and I still can't figure out why it was fought." So that's what we're up against here, folks. But I did think it was very odd that the European countries who were involved, the major powers, had a commemoration on June 28th of this year, marking the start of World War I, because that wasn't the start of World War I at all. That was the 100th anniversary of the day that the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and his wife, Countess Sophie, were assassinated while they were on a visit to Sarajevo. So at that point, it wasn't clear at all what that would mean to the situation. And the situation was very convoluted by that point because of all these treaties of mutual defense. And the Triple Entente was agreements between England and Russia, England and France, that if any of those three were attacked, that the other parties in the Entente, which means accord, friendship agreement, would come to their military defense and help protect them. So those three were in cahoots. And then what became called the Central Powers was basically Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And nominally, Italy was considered one of the Central Powers, although that switched. But at that point, they were. So it was very much a situation where there was interdependence of economic trade by that point. And because of that, a lot of people felt, well, it's not like the old situation in the 19th century. We're really so interlinked now that it must be more stable. And that was the theme of a book that was written in 1909 in England by Norman Angell called The Great Illusion. And his thesis was that it would be futile in this situation for anyone to declare war. He said, by impressive examples and incontrovertible argument, he showed that the present financial and economic interdependence of nations, in this situation, the victor would suffer equally with the vanquished. Therefore, war had become unprofitable. Therefore, no nation would be so foolish as to start one. And this book was translated into 11 European languages. There was sort of a cult of study around it at the big universities in England and on the continent. It was really the book of the day. With its, he didn't say war would be impossible. He just said it would be futile because it would be economically ruinous for everyone involved. So that was the big book everywhere in Europe except in Germany. And they had a different big book. And it was written by General Friedrich von Bernhardi. And this book was called Germany and the Next War. It was published in 1911. And you can get an idea from a few of its chapter titles what his thesis was. So these chapters were The Right to Make War, The Duty to Make War, World Power or Downfall. And he started out with his chapter called Germany's Historic Mission. So There's a summary of this in Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of War, which I think is very good, this paragraph. I just want to read this to you because it's so important for reasons you'll see, but also one more I'll tell you at the end of this paragraph. So von Bernhardi states that war is a biological necessity. It is the carrying out among humankind of the natural law upon which all the laws of nature rest, the law of struggle for existence. You can see the social Darwinism in here, right? Interpreted in the usual self-serving ways. Nations, he said, must progress or decay. There can be no standing still. And Germany must choose world power or downfall. Among the nations, Germany is in social political respects at the head of all progress in culture, but it is compressed into narrow, unnatural limits. I'll break in here and explain. They had a term encirclement, meaning they felt they were encircled by these other powers who didn't really respect them in spite of their great composers and philosophers and universities and high culture. And this was intolerable. So somehow they concluded the way to get respect from our neighbors is to overrun them. Anyway, back to the summary of his book, Germany and the Next War, 1911. So we're stuck with these narrow, unnatural limits. Germany cannot attain her great moral ends without increased political power, an enlarged sphere of influence, and new territory. Now, let me break in again and say Lebensraum. I thought the concept of Lebensraum, which means living room or living space, came in with the Nazis. It's the idea in Germany that, Eastern Europe and Russia are just sitting there. We might as well spread out and own it and annex it because we need a little more space. But actually, it starts with World War I, and the phrase was coined by a political philosopher around 1903 in Germany. So here he's talking about Lebensraum, our natural right for more living space. enlarged sphere of influence and new territory. This increase in power befitting our importance and which we are entitled to claim is a political necessity and is the first and foremost duty of the state. And then in his own italics, he added, what we now wish to attain must be fought for. Conquest thus becomes a law of necessity. And then once he proves the so-called necessity, he moves on to the method and says, once the duty to make war is recognized, the secondary duty to make it successfully follows. To be successful, a state must begin war at the most favorable moment of its own choosing. It has the acknowledged right to secure the proud privilege of such an initiative. Offensive war thus becomes another necessity, and a second conclusion then becomes inescapable. Quote, it is incumbent on us to act on the offensive and strike the first blow. Von Bernhardi did not share Kaiser Wilhelm's concern about the odium, as Kaiser Wilhelm put it, that's attached to being an aggressor. Nor was von Bernhardi reluctant to tell where the blow would fall. It is, quote, unthinkable, he wrote, that Germany and France could ever negotiate their problems. Quote, France must be so completely crushed that she can never cross our path again. She must be annihilated once and for all as a great power. So that was the big book in Germany in the years before the war. And the interesting thing is that the military establishment in Germany and France, especially in Germany, but they had very detailed plans of how they would invade to the east and the west, not at the same time, because they were very afraid of having to fight a war on two fronts, which is what happened, of course, as you know. But the planning was absolutely fascinating to see how detailed it was. And this was started 8, 7, 6, 5 years before war broke out. And they had, with the usual German efficiency, all these plans worked out such that they could tell you, you know, how many troops in each train would cover each quarter mile of track in so many portions of an hour going toward a certain destination, and, you know, where the facilities could be built in the build-up to the war. And everything was worked out in great, great detail. And, again, one of the interesting things I learned was that the political establishment, the governing establishment, was in a very different place. You know, they were talking about these agreements, and it was all very, what can I say, almost surreal. Trying to outthink the other person, trying to outfox them with these agreements, trying to interpret what everyone else's chess move had just made. There was one story I saw about 20 years ago where a foreign minister of one of the great powers died, and his counterpart in an opposition country heard this news, and he said, I wonder what his motivation could have been. So that's where the government and diplomatic corps was. Meanwhile, the military folks are just, you know, building up all these plans and this momentum for war. And in France, they didn't have this expansionist aim. They were very deeply pained by the fact that they'd lost Alsace and Lorraine after the Franco-Prussian War, 1870 and 71. And so Germany took those two areas in between France and the Rhine to be part of Germany. So they wanted Alsace-Lorraine back. But they weren't about to, you know, 40 years it had been like that. They didn't like it, but they weren't about to declare war on Germany to get those two provinces back. So among the great powers, really, Germany was the only one who had this expansionist momentum building in very big ways, philosophically and, you know, almost religiously, what our destiny is. And as I say, you could see the social Darwinism. But I also would like you to just remember what I just read you about the big book in Germany before World War One, because after the war, when we get to the aftermath, you're going to see they try to erase that entirely. That never happened. Nobody thought that way. Nobody talked that way. Instead, there was a totally different cause. We were so afraid somebody was going to invade us, and it wasn't France. So anyway, in France, they also were making military plans because they felt after the Franco-Prussian War, after the German invasion, that they had to be always ready. And they also got a little squirrely. They felt, well, the Germans are really good soldiers, but we have this élan. The French soldier has this élan, and this was borrowed from the philosopher Henri Bergson's concept, élan vital, this life force, and combined with something they called cran, which was like guts or determination. The French soldier could always, you know, push on through. And we almost always be taking the offensive in any battle. Never defense. Oh, that's a shameful position. We all say, da-da-da-da-da. So they were getting pumped up in their own way, not nearly as much as the Germans. But all that really overcame what the governments could do. It was interesting that when the crisis finally happened after the assassination, and it got very, very close. Well, I'll tell you how it got close. But the governmental people were very nervous and tried to back things up and tried to stop it. But the momentum, once started, had such a great push that it just went forward. So let's see. Oh, yes, there was one other country that had expansionist desires as part of this mix. And it wasn't one of the big countries. It was a small country on the periphery. And this was the Kingdom of Serbia. Serbia had been occupied by the Ottoman Empire for several hundred years. And then in the 1870s, actually Bosnia and Herzegovina had pushed, Istanbul had pushed the Ottoman Empire for their independence. And the final result was that they became a protectorate that was nominally, jointly governed by the Ottomans and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but the Ottoman Empire soon fell away from that. It was a protectorate under the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then later, after the turn of the century, they simply annexed it as one of the provinces of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, right next to Croatia. So Serbia had become independent, but they had this idea in their mind that we should have more territory. What we have isn't big enough for us, and we rightfully should annex our neighbors, Kosovo, Montenegro, part of Macedonia, tried to take, went into Bulgaria, and certainly Bosnia and Herzegovina. Because, they said, in the 1300s, that had been part of the Kingdom of Serbia. Well, a lot had happened since then, like the Ottoman occupation, and Bosnia and Herzegovina was not Serbian anymore. Only 40% of the population was Serbian, and they didn't want to become part of a greater Serbia. Another 40% were Islamic. They had converted, either forced to be converted or had voluntarily converted to Islam during those hundreds of years of occupation by the Ottoman Empire. So it's 40% Serbians of the Serbian Orthodox Christian Church, 40% Islamic, and 20% Catholic of Croatian background in the north, and into Sarajevo as well. So certainly the 40% that were Islamic thought, you know, we're better off in this state with these mixture of different religions, including Jewish. There was certainly a Jewish community in Sarajevo that had come there at the time Spain expelled the Jews in 1492. So they said, you know, this is an interfaith culture. This is the way we want it to stay. But Serbia said, no, no, you know, you're rightfully, you should be part of Greater Serbia. So toward that end, there was a movement of citizens. It wasn't a state movement for this Greater Serbia annexing of their neighbors. And it was members of that movement of individuals who went to Sarajevo and assassinated the Archduke when he was there on a state visit and shot his wife as well when they were in an open carriage. Why did they pick him as a target? Well, not only was he the heir to the throne, but he had said, you know, I think we have so many southern Slavic people in the Austro-Hungarian Empire now that we should have some reforms, more autonomy, like we did with Hungary. And we should even change the name to reflect Austro-Hungarian and maybe Southern Slavic Empire or something like that. So he had spoken of those reforms, which sat well with Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia and Herzegovina, but it was horrifying to the Serbians, who felt it would be taking Bosnia and Herzegovina tighter, more tightly into the Austro-Hungarian Empire and farther away from the possibility of being part of Greater Serbia. So they assassinated him. And they, by the way, had secretly gotten funding from the high intelligence officers in the Serbian government, but it was all under the table. So it was this movement of individual independent citizens. And there's a little parallel here of what happened next with, actually with 9/11, because this was a criminal act by a group of individuals. But the state in which it took part made a huge response to another state instead of treating it as a criminal act of individuals. So this is what they called the July crisis, when all the governments went into a tizzy and all these telegrams were flying around, and what's this going to mean? What's this going to mean? And Austro-Hungary, there have been lots of what they call the Balkan Wars, where Serbia militarily, you know, went to war to grab Kosovo and then Montenegro. And so there'd been lots of turmoil there. And they had all these declarations by various people high up in the Serbian government saying Bosnia-Herzegovina should really be part of us, not part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So when this happened, when the assassination happened, the Austro-Hungarian Empire decided, we are fed up with this, and we are just going to crush these people. And so they didn't invade them initially. They gave them an ultimatum. And the ultimatum said, we know the government supported these people in doing the assassination, and that the there is a culpable tolerance, very obvious, in the Royal Serbian government for what happened. And so they put this list of conditions. You have to try these people. They had the names of two of the five for the murder of the Archduke. And you have to stop putting out these public expressions that Bosnia-Herzegovina should be not in our empire but in yours. And you have to stop teaching that in the textbooks, take it out of your textbooks. And it went on and on, including you have to make a public explanation of why people high in your government were making these kinds of statements recently. So they delivered this ultimatum, and most historians feel it was delivered to be impossible for Serbia to meet. But actually, Serbia did acquiesce, and it did say, okay, okay, we'll try them, we'll do all this, we'll take it out of the textbooks, we'll stop saying this. And just like maybe they stopped short of the last one or something about do public soul searching about why these statements were happening in the first place. And so this went back to Vienna and also to Germany, and the Kaiser looked at it and he says, well, they've taken away any reason for war, but war happened anyway. Austro-Hungary then attacked Serbia. So it was a big power attacking a little power who was not in any of the Entente agreements. But Serbia had a friend in Russia because of the cultural connections. They didn't have a treaty, but they had what Russia called the Pan-Slavic philosophical kinship that they would help other Slavic countries, especially since they had the Orthodox religion in common. So Russia said, we'll come to your aid. You can't be invaded by this empire. And then when Russia was involved, then the French said, uh-oh, this means we're involved. Germany, before the Austro-Hungarians invaded, said to Vienna, because they were so eager to go to war, a month before, the head of their military had said, we're totally ready and we hope it happens soon, some little spark somewhere, we're really ready. And so Germany assured Vienna, we'll help you if you want to fight back and really annihilate Serbia. So all that was pushing things, and indeed then this is what happened at the end of July. And July 23rd, Austria gives the ultimatum to Serbia. July 26th, they reject Serbia's reply. July 28th, they declare war on Serbia. July 29th, they bombard Belgrade. And that's the beginning. So then Russia mobilizes all her forces along the Austrian border on July 30th. So that's how one assassination leads to everybody having to jump in. But still, at the same time, late July then into early August is where also in the north, Germany starts making a move and invades Luxembourg. And, oh, I see I have to stop here for the break. I'm a little, this is just such a thrilling story, isn't it? But tragic. Anyway, we'll be right back. Pause for the break. This is All Together Now with Charlene Spretnak. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak, and today we're considering various aspects and ramifications of World War I. So, that's how it started, and I'll just quickly go through some of the points about how it was fought. One of the interesting things I learned is that all the powers thought the other guys were totally useless. For instance, in Germany's war plans, they said, the Belgians, they're not going to make any resistance. The French, they're nothing. And among all of them, including the French and the English, they had the experience of colonial wars from 30 years earlier, when they had just mowed down these poor colonial powers. They were on horseback, you know, they had guns and everything, and the colonial powers had spears or knives or whatever. So in their minds, we're such great soldiers, and nobody, you know, gives us pause, except maybe, I guess, the British couldn't say that after Afghanistan, Khyber Pass. Anyway, so, they all had that in mind. It was like a collective self-inflated narcissism or something. But one of the big points was they were using, in the first part of the war, old military tactics against new weapons that they had no idea of. So they would, actually, there were saber charges on the eastern French frontier of the French into rifle fire by the Germans. And then when the Germans invaded Belgium, they brought these huge guns in called Big Bertha that were like monstrous things being rolled through the conquered cities and set up to shell whatever forts were left. But just the idea also later, once they get into the trenches, because the war was mobile in the first 6 months and the last 6 months, and then in between then it was stagnant in the trenches. But when people would be ordered to go over the trenches, they would be walking right into machine gun fire. You know, it just took a long time to sort of adjust the tactics to the technology. In this war, as I've said, all kinds of horrible new things were invented. Flamethrowers, poison gas that was pushed through tubes, first by the Germans and then the British and French. The first bombing of civilians was the Germans bombing the people of Liège in Belgium for not surrendering instantly so they could walk through Belgium to France. And they used Zeppelin blimps and dropped bombs from the Zeppelins. And same thing in London a little later, the second year, 1915. They had Zeppelins go across the channel and dropped bombs, ostensibly on the East End munition factories, but they didn't have any guidance system, so hit a lot of civilians. And then there was the destruction of Louvain in Belgium. That was called, that was their great medieval city, as Barbara Tuchman put it. It dated from 1428 when Berlin was just a collection of wooden huts, as she said. But it was their medieval library and all kinds of art treasures. People called it, you know, the Belgian Oxford. And so that was just bombed into rubble. And then, as you know, the big battles on the east, Tannenberg in Germany, the Russian army went all the way in, but were defeated at Tannenberg with huge losses to the Germans as well as the Russians, even though the Russians got pushed back. Then the Germans made it almost all the way into Paris. The first battle of the Marne is only about 30 miles outside of Paris. They get pushed back. And then two big offensives, Verdun. The Germans figure, we're just going to end this once and for all with this big siege, 1916 in February, but they lose a lot. Both sides, of course, always lose a lot. Then the British thought, we're going to end this once and for all with this big battle at the Somme River. July 1st, 1916, on the first day of that battle, 58,000 British troops were killed. So all this time, you know, people were saying in Europe, why are the Americans isolationists? And President Woodrow Wilson said, no, we're not isolationists. We're neutral so that we can help out working out a peace. But the Lusitania was sunk, and we eventually went in 1917, of course. Actually, the American troops only saw combat in the last 8 months of the war. And General Pershing, he had that same kind of macho self-absorption. He'd think, these French guys, these English guys, they're nothing. We'll just charge harder into the machine fire. And so we had huge losses when he was doing that old-time charge into these new weapons. But then they finally, under the British General Douglas Haig unified their air support, tanks, and infantry, and that's when they pushed Germany back. So there was finally the armistice at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, which wasn't a peace. It was just a ceasefire so that peace terms could be negotiated in what became the Treaty of Versailles. But this wasn't signed until July 1919. And now we'll go into the aftermath of the war, because there was a blockade of Germany. Oh, dear, I'm going to run way out of time, because I do want to not cut out the arts corner, which I always think is as essential as the rest of the program. Anyway, the blockade led to the starvation of all kinds of huge numbers, 450,000 German soldiers, 100,000 civilians starved to death in that first year after the peace. And the Germans had this whole campaign after the war. We weren't guilty. We were afraid Russia was going to invade us. It wasn't our fault. And then a big problem was because the Treaty of Westphalia, and you can still see this in the news commentators today and the historians that are on all the news programs. Oh, well, all these little countries showed up. I mean, they can't get it that any longstanding cultural entity, a nation, would have any right to be a state. And later, Leopold Kohr made the case in 1957 when he wrote his book, The Breakdown of Nations, the world would be safer with smaller modern states because big ones do big damage. So anyway, because they didn't have a sense of that, the lines in the Middle East weren't drawn correctly. Obviously, there should be a Kurdistan, not the Kurds divided in three countries. And all kinds of things were done in a very callous, ignorant way by not paying attention to the nations. And then there was, on the good side, the Wilsonian inheritance of self-determination and internationalism. And finally, after the League of Nations failed, got the United Nations, and finally got an International War Crimes Tribunal in the late 1990s, which they tried to get after World War I. So one of the uses, though, that went forward after this Wilsonian kind of thinking, you know, he, as I said, introduced the concept of self-determination, very important in the post-colonial struggles, and also his phrase, to make the world safe for democracy. So there was this idea that America is here to further democratic values and structures around the world. And that was, you know, kind of in the background. After World War II, of course, we were fighting the opposite. We would do everything we could to fight the communist alternative. But then in the Reagan administration, you know, they say, we're not here to force democracy or even go out of our way to set up democracy anywhere. And surprisingly, it was brought out of the cupboard again by George Bush after 9/11. You know, he said, it's really important to us to set up democratic institutions in the Middle East. We think that would really fix everything. In spite of the fact that, you know, in the tapes, Bin Laden said clearly the reason 9/11 happened were two reasons. One, you had American military troops in our holy land, Saudi Arabia, because Mecca and Medina now there. And two, the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. So ignoring both of those, you know, the Bush administration said, if we just force democracy on the Middle East, no, the Palestinian thing will shake out by itself. And there will be with American troops on another Islamic country. That'll be swell. That couldn't possibly set off decades and decades of anger. And I did, the last thing I want to do here is share with you this outrageous quote I found from the Bush administration when he was, as I say, dusting off Wilsonian thinking. And at the time, when he talked about, oh, if we just put, you know, a democracy in Iraq, I thought, how's that going to help your position? I mean, if people are angry, at our foreign policy and the behavior of our corporations, how would a democratic process really change their attitude toward us? They would just vote for people who would implement policies demonstrating they're really angry at our foreign policy and corporate behavior. Wouldn't it be better to like try to figure out if they have any just reasons or not for being angry at us? But, of course, they weren't in a mood to think that through, because just like the British after World War One, Cheney, Halliburton, they had their eye on the oil. They wanted very safe access to the oil. Anyway, they're hiding behind this Wilsonian democracy thing. And Richard Pearl, you remember Richard Pearl, who earned the nickname the Prince of Darkness in the peace movement during the first half of the Reagan administration? And then he was back in at the center in the Bush 2 administration. So he said, you know, in accord with this idea of America should enforce these democratic values, and their favorite target was the Middle East, quote, "I think there is a potential civic culture in Arab countries that can lead to democratic institutions." This is Richard Pearl speaking in March 2001, quote, "and I think that Iraq is probably the best place to put that proposition to the test." So keep in mind that March 2001 was just a few weeks after the first cabinet meeting, during which President George W. Bush had said to his cabinet, quote, "find me a way to go into Iraq," unquote, his first cabinet meeting. Which, of course, was reported by, who was the Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, and it was corroborated by someone else, another secretary, in that meeting. Anyway, such were the uses of Wilsonian thinking for people who had other ends in mind. Okay, let's move over to the Arts Corner for our poem this week. I'm going to read an excerpt from the prose poem called In Parenthesis by the Welsh-English poet and visual artist David Jones. And W.H. Auden said that this was the best poem written about the Great War. T.S. Eliot called it brilliant in the introduction he wrote for it when it was first published in 1937. So this little excerpt I'm going to read is from the beginning and the end of the declaration made by one of the characters, one of the men in the platoon that's featured in the story. He's a universal soldier named Dai, D-A-I, Greatcoat. This Dai adjusts his slipping shoulder straps, that is, suspenders, wraps close his misfit outsized greatcoat. He articulates his English with alien care. "My fathers were with the Black Prince of Wales at the Passion of the Blind Bohemian King. They served in these fields. It is in the histories that you can read, Corporal. Boys Gower they were. It is writ down, yes. What about Methusalem, Taffy? I was with Abel when his brother found him under the green tree. I built a shit house for Artaxerxes. I was the spear in Balin's hand that made waste King Pelham's land. I took the smooth stones of the brook. I was with Saul playing before him. I saw him armed like Durfal Gotterin. I, the fox run fire consuming in the wheat lands." And then from the end, "I was in Michael's trench when bright Lucifer bulged his primal salient out. That caused it. That upset the joy cart and three parts waste. You ought to ask, why? What is this? What is the meaning of this? Because you don't ask, although the spear shaft drips, there's neither steading, not a roof tree. I am the single horn thrusting by night stream margin in Helion. Cripes a mighty, strike me stone cold, you don't say. Where's that birthmark, young'un? What the Mitchell's dick and still fading. Jump to it, Rothersfield. Never die, never die. Never die, never die. Old soldiers never die. never die, never die, old soldiers, never die. They never die, never die, old soldiers, never die. They simply fade away. For our song this week, we'll hear the American Enlistment Anthem of 1917. The strategically engaging and patriotic march Over There, written by George M. Cohan, in which he managed to make war sound like a picnic that needs a few hundred thousand good men. Here it is.
Get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, go today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud her boy's in line. Over there, over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums rum coming everywhere, so prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware, we'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there, over there, over there. Send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums rum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there.
Gun, get your gun, get your gun. Johnny, show the Hun you're a son of a gun. Hoist the flag and let her fly. Yankee Doodle, do or die. Pack your little kit, show your grit, do your bit. Yankees to the ranks, from the towns and the tanks. Make your mother proud of you, and the old red, white, and blue.
Over there, over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drum, drum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come. The drum, drum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there.
That was Over There, written by George M. Cohan. The opening line you heard, Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun, is the reference in the title of the anti-war novel, Johnny Got His Gun, written in 1939 by Dalton Trumbo about a veteran of World War I. Trumbo was later blacklisted as a screenwriter, of course, and then in 1971 he directed his film adaptation of this novel. And then a more recent version of Johnny Got His Gun was made in 2008. And then the last line of Over There you heard, and we won't be back till it's over, over there. That line is altered a bit. in a film that's a really excellent and slightly surreal anti-war film about World War I entitled Oh, What a Lovely War, made in the late 60s. It was based on a play that the Joan Littlewood Theater Company wrote in London, using a lot of the direct quotes from the generals that were gathered together in Barbara Tuchman's book. They said her book was their Bible for writing this play because the quotes are so astounding. Anyway, it's really well done, and I highly recommend the film Oh, What a Lovely War. And in that version, the American troops arrive in France in 1917, and they sing Over There with this altered closing line, and we won't be back, we'll be buried over there. And so it was. Some 116,000 American soldiers were killed during the 8 months they were in combat in France during the final year of the war. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespratnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on August 28th with my guest, David Simon, editor of the architectural journal EAP, who will share his insights on a sense of place. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.